Pittsburgh, I love ya. This is Brian Edward, and you're listening to Berg Vivant, Pittsburgh's cultural talk magazine, delivered digitally, straight up, shaken, and stirred. Tonight's broadcast brought to you by our spectacular sponsors and strategic partners, Zafalo's Banquet and Event Center, Carnegie, Pennsylvania, one of the most beautiful and unique venues in the greater Pittsburgh area for weddings, corporate dinners, fundraisers, and more. Visit clubzafalo.com. Off the Wall Theater, enlivening, educating, and entertaining audiences in the Pittsburgh region. View their current season at insideoffthewall.com. Arcade Comedy Theater, hosting local and national comedians, sketch comedy, improv, and more. 811 Liberty Avenue, downtown. Be sure to like them on Facebook or find them at arcadecomedytheater.com. Berg Vivant is a proud supporter of Firefly Arts, creating opportunities and support for families living with autism through innovative arts programming. You can learn more and show your support at fireflyarts.org. Tonight's guest, the lovely Kim Eel.
Thank you.
Good to see you. Very good to see you.
Good to be here.
Oh,
thank you.
Yes, in Pittsburgh Playwrights Theater Company,
which
we'll talk about in a bit. But we like to kick off with a local headline from the Pittsburgh region. And I happen to see today that La Trobe will host the first ever Great American Banana Split Festival. There will be a 50s sock hop with a hula hoop and Dole's Bobby Banana, a 6-foot-tall banana character, will be an honorary co-chair for the event. Now, I don't know about you, but any event at which a 6-foot banana encourages me to have ice cream is my kind of event.
Yeah.
What do you think about this?
I like banana splits and... people don't eat banana splits a lot, do they? You don't hear people saying, I'm going out to get a banana split.
It's a commitment.
Yeah, it's a lot.
You've got to, first of all, have that appetite and, you know, be prepared to, because I think what constitutes a banana split is, of course, the banana.
Yeah.
3 scoops of ice cream, which I think are chocolate, vanilla, and strawberry, unless you request something else. And then... All the sauces.
Sauces and the nuts and the cherry.
Oh, yes, we can't forget
and
that.
And the cherry. And it's funny you would mention banana splits. One time I worked at KDKA, and I was Perry Marshall's producer. And on the show, we did the show from an Eaton Park, and they said, what do you like about Eaton Park? And I said, the banana splits. And they, through the phone lines, people sent banana splits, like you send somebody a drink. So I had like 3 banana splits.
Oh, they called the Eaton Park and they ordered them up for you.
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking, that's not something that's really going to go well in the mail.
They called Eaton Park. And so I had these banana splits sitting here at night. Which a banana split, how many calories is that? That's too many.
It's up there.
Yeah, it's a lot of calories. So, I mean, it was fun. But that's my banana split memory.
Well, we want all of our viewers to know that I like martinis. So we'll see if any of those show up here. But they're having this in La Trobe because the banana split supposedly was invented in La Trobe. Did you know this? Yes.
Oh, how did you know that?
I read it in the article.
Oh.
You know, I didn't know it before that. But it doesn't surprise me because, you know, this region, I don't know what it is. And I was just talking to... the executive head chef at Lydia's, Jeremy Wojtisch, about this because it was another article that we had pulled out of the news. This area is known for the invention of a lot of creatively layered foods.
Wow.
The banana split, the Big Mac from McDonald's was invented in Uniontown, which is about an hour and a half south of here. And of course, Primanti's came up with fries on sandwiches.
Yeah, so Burger King is trying to do that.
Right, I saw that.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
So I'm thrilled that Pittsburgh is, you know, being considered one of the most livable cities in America.
We
just like horrible combinations of food, you know, or maybe creative. I don't know.
Creative, because I like French fries on my sandwich.
Mm-hmm. I don't mind it.
It's
and
great.
The story I heard how that originated was the steel mills here. And when, you know, you kind of brought your lunch because you only got a short lunch break. But the original Permanis, which was in the Strip District, mm-hmm. some of them were able to run over quick enough to Permane's and get their lunch, but because they had such a short time to eat it, Permane's started putting the coleslaw and the french fries all on one sandwich so they could eat it quickly.
That's an interesting story.
I don't know if it's true.
That's a good one.
That's what I've just always heard.
Let's say it is a true story.
So the
put that in a play. That's amazing.
So the banana split was invented because somebody was maybe lacking potassium. We could come up with something for that.
It was a party, and they just said, give it all in a one bowl. Give me it in a boat. Give me a boat full of ice cream with a banana.
So Pittsburgh's got great food. It's got great playwrights.
Thank you.
Great directors, of which you are all of the above.
Thank you.
Poet as well. Yeah. You do it all.
I like it.
What describes Kim Eel in a word?
Eclectic. Is that a good word?
Yeah.
Yay!
Because that's like another word for a lot of words.
Yeah.
So that was pretty sly there.
Yeah, I like, me in one word would be creatively blessed.
I like that.
That's two words, actually.
Well, we can hyphenate it and, get away with it.
Yeah, but I'm
in charge here. I say it's all right. That's good.
But I like the fact that I can do what I want to do in a creative way, and other people get some benefits from it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So where do you get your inspiration?
At one time I would say from other people, that are successful artists, but today I feel I get my inspiration inwardly. I'm going on a self-discovery thing. So I'm thinking, okay, Kim, what would you like to do today? When I write plays, I hear the stories. So I hear the characters. If I were to direct, I see the vision before it actually happens. And it's no one else in that room that inspires me to do it. But an overall inspiration is from people who came before me.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of their ethnic or cultural or racial background, but creatives that have come before me are those that inspire me.
That have given those gifts to us.
Yeah.
I like that.
Mm-hmm.
So when did you start? What was your first theatrical experience?
First theatrical experience was, I want to say in high school. It probably was before that. People do little things in church or somewhere.
Oh, sure,
do a little thing like that. But the real theatrical experience was in high school, at Schenley High School. And I had an opportunity to assistant director for a Guys and Dolls play. And I was assistant director, but also had a small part in the play. And when you hear the claps at the end, it's like a rush.
Mm-hmm.
You know that.
Mm-hmm. I do.
Yes,
I must say.
So it was a rush from that. And I said I wanted to have that feeling again. It's almost like you eat a banana split, and you're like, whoa, that was a sugar rush. Let's do that again.
Yeah.
And so that was my creative rush, was my little tiny time at Schenley High School. And I wanted to keep doing that again.
And ever since.
And I've been doing it.
So where do you feel that switch took place as far as getting that inspiration from others and then looking within yourself for it?
I think the switch took place when I became more confident. A lot of artists have this inward doubt until we are verified or we get this, yay, you did it. The clap is the, yes, you did it.
Hmm.
And until, I will say the last 7 or 8 years, I doubted my work. I just thought it was something I liked to do. I didn't think people would like it as much, but I always give my 100%. I give my A game all the time. And that counts when you give your A game, when you're writing a play or when you are performing or when you are directing and you don't want to settle for less.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's when I first started going inward, saying, you don't have to do this because someone else did it. You are you now. You've mm-hmm. made yourself a name. Or when I was in Target one day and someone said, I know who you are. You did that play. I'm thinking, wow, for real? I am that person. Dun, dun, dun.
When they know you at Target, you know you have made it.
They know you at Target or Walmart, man. Someone stops you in Macy's, they may just be doing that but if they stop you in Target or Walmart, you have arrived.
Now, you mentioned confidence, and you know, I look at you as I look at most performers and artists that, you know, the last thing that they're doing is doubting themselves because they seem so confident.
It's an
to,
act.
To put yourself out there. And that's what I find when I talk to a lot of them. And even when I share my own stage experiences with people, sometimes they're surprised. So what do you feel are your greatest challenges as an artist in expressing yourself?
The greatest challenge is to believe that I am capable of what I'm actually doing. It's not until the actual show is over, more so on acting than it is in the directing and the playwriting. I'm more confident in my playwriting, more confident in my directing, but when it comes to acting, it's not until I've seen myself on video or when people stop me on the street and say, oh my God, I really enjoyed that. And I'm thinking, for real? You did? Wow. So I would say not a weakness, but my, the layering. I would layer myself and feelings. And one of the lowest part of my layers is that the believability. Mm. You know, that you believed me. But now, as I step myself up, I want you to believe me. And when I coach or when I do workshops, I say the number one thing is believability. And so when I'm coaching someone, the first thing I say to them is, I don't believe you. I didn't believe you when you, I didn't believe that. I don't believe you. What? I don't believe you. So, and I've learned that because for me, if I don't believe what I see on video, and I'll say, oh, I need to do that again. Mm-hmm. I didn't believe me. I didn't believe I was an old lady. I didn't believe I was a child. I didn't believe I was drunk. I didn't believe I was crying. So that's, yeah, the believability.
And I think one of the greatest things that an artist can do to better themselves is look back and reflect on their own journey learn things from it. Clearly, mm-hmm. you've got that. And the products have been phenomenal. Again, poet, playwright, director, technical theater maven, too. We've gone a lot back to playwriting. Do you feel that that is where your the most of your motivation is? Yeah. Is that you know, if you had to choose one and focus, not that we would ever ask that of you.
To choose one, it would be playwriting. I was once told by Woody King, he's a well-known for Federal Theater. He's a director, producer, and a well-known person in the creative world. And he said to me, are you a writer? And I said, yes. He said, do you write every day? And at that time, I didn't. I said, no. He said, then you're not a writer. And so it made me realize that as a playwright, I need to revisit and to write more. That's where I get joy. I can remember writing something, going to work, a regular 9-to-5 job, and coming home thinking, I can't wait to talk to those characters again. I can't wait to see what they say. I can't wait to see where they go. So the understanding that these are my friends in my head or whatever is the fun part. But when I'm acting, I'm like, oh my God, I gotta remember all of those lines.
And they're someone else's lines.
Yeah,
unless they're yours.
Even when they're mine. It's really hard.
Wow.
It's hard. My mother said, did you really write that? Why are you freaking out? Because you have to remember it. Because I want to do it word for word, you know, on stage, the way that I wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
And but playwriting is so much more easier because I can write it, I can go away and watch someone else breathe life into it.
That's a great experience.
Mm-hmm.
Is there one that resonates with you more than others, that one of your productions above all that really, really you might look at as one of your greatest successes?
Right now, Straightening Combs. It's a one-woman show. I play 7 different characters. It's based on my true life, and it's it deals with me growing up in the housing projects, having a low self-esteem, going to Duquesne University, working at KDK and different places, and still having a low self-esteem, and finally triumphing as throughout it all as I made it. And what makes this one of my favorites is that it's helped so many people. You know, I've done it, this will be my 3rd time doing it, and the last night that I did it, a woman walked up to me and she hugged me. And she said, thank you so much. She was crying. And I said, you're welcome. And she was still holding me, and I tried to let go. And she said, no, you don't understand. I was going to kill myself. Until I told my friend, and she said, I want you to see this play.
Wow.
And I've had that feedback from people because it deals with dealing with clinical depression or mental illness. And a lot of people thought that I never ever, because I'm so happy and ha ha ha, would have suffered from clinical depression. So the play is based on depression and dealing with it and how people get there. The play was originally called Straightening Combs and Other Things That Have Changed My Life. That was too long. So I cut it down to Straightening Combs, and I had no idea the impact it would have on people. And so for that reason, because it's helpful, that's one of my favorites.
What impact did it have on you in writing something so personal, first of all, performing in something so personal, and sharing that with others? Because you're very frank about it.
Yeah.
And I think that takes a lot of courage, not only to discuss it,
yes,
but to put yourself in front of an audience, mm-hmm, not as a only a playwright and as only an actress, but as that human being. I think a lot of times when we act, and even when we write, we're putting on a mask.
Yes.
But this is you. That's you out there. So how has it changed you?
It has given me the confidence that I lacked the years prior to getting the confidence now. I had this facade that everything was okay. You know, there was a book out a while ago, I'm Okay, You're Okay. I really was not okay. And so I did the show here at the Playwrights Theater in March of this year, of 2013, and I did 12 shows. And so to do the show, replaying my life over and over again, I was like, wow, because it deals with domestic violence, it deals with low self-esteem, as I've said, it deals with a lot of things that is not just dealing with me as an African-American female growing up in the inner city, I grew up in the housing projects, but it also is a universal story, because I had a white woman come up to me and say, I can totally relate, I lived in a trailer park, and I felt ostracized, and I felt low self-esteem, and I felt that. So I originally wrote this play as the checkoff of a bucket list. You know, what should I do before I die? Let's see, write and produce and perform in a play. Check. But I didn't think that other people would really just gravitate to this, to my story. So at the end of the day, and I cry in this movie, I have a full-blown nervous breakdown. So every time I had a nervous breakdown in this play, it was purging me of past things. Someone walked up to me and said, wow, you were so transparent in this. And I never really thought that I was being transparent. I thought I was just telling a story. But I was transparent.
And you've done it many times,
yes,
for many audiences.
Yes.
It's very well received everywhere. How is it doing it now, the 15th, 20th, 30th time?
Still the same feelings, and which means that I was layered with all these stories that were not presented effectively. And each time I do it, I was thinking, what if I get all of the sadness out, and now the play's not going to be sad anymore? But it still comes out. It's still, the tears still come out, the story still comes out as it is. And I don't know whether it's just God saying, look, you were sad, give them sad, you know, or that I'm an actor, don't try this at home. I don't know, but it comes out each time, it still comes out. I will be doing it again in October, and I'm hoping that it still comes out. I'm thinking that it will, because I want people to feel it. I want people to know that there is life after depression. There is positive after negative, that you can smile at the end of your rainbow, at the end of your storm, you know, so, yeah.
Having gone through this experience, do you feel that now as an artist, you are operating as a whole more functionally now after having gone, faced this and gaining that confidence that you hadn't before?
I'll say that again. As an artist, I want to see if I fully understand your question.
One of the things that I recall you saying is that, you know, what it did for how it changed it was to give you that confidence that you were lacking before. Mm-hmm. So now having that, you know, are you operating as an artist differently now? That you, is it as simple as that this filled a void or this patched a hole? Do you approach work differently now after having gone through this experience?
Oh, yes.
This therapy, in a sense,
oh, yeah.
Is it fair to call it that?
Oh, very much so. It was very therapeutic. In the play, I actually say poetry and playwriting is my Prozac. And I say that in the play.
That needs to be a bumper sticker.
Oh, yeah. I need to put it on a t-shirt because...
Let's make that happen.
Yeah.
We can make that happen.
Poetry and playwriting is my Prozac. And well, actually, one of my... I got the poetry is my Prozac from one of my poetry friends. She... I don't know whether it was the title of a play, Ngozi. So if you're listening, Ngozi, I didn't steal your thing. But I loved that. And because when I hear it... Because Prozac's expensive. Poetry is not. Playwriting is not. And so it's an outlet for me to shake off some of those barbed wires. And yes, I have grown from this. I've totally, totally grown. I accept myself as an artist. When I was just starting off, people said, you don't want to do that. I originally wanted to go to the Art Institute of Pittsburgh to be an artist. And my mother said, no, because what are you going to do if you're not really a good artist? And so I...
Thanks, Ma.
Yeah, thanks, Ma. thanks for the confidence, Mom. So I went to Mansfield State College at that time, Mansfield University now, and I majored in English. And my mother said, take art lessons there so that way you can still take your art lessons, but then you'll have a degree. And so I partied really hard up there.
Atta girl.
Partied. And so I came back to Pittsburgh and I went to Duquesne University, which they don't play. They're like, you better stop partying or else. So I graduated from Duquesne, took some art classes there, but I had a newfound understanding of being an adult. And I think that's where I'm at now, that I had this newfound understanding of being an artist. I feel that I can make some money as an artist, not a whole lot in Pittsburgh, unfortunately, but I can make money as an artist and that I can entertain as an artist. And again, if you walk through Target and someone has seen you in a play, they will point you out. Because I don't see who's in the dark. So if an old lady says, hey, you're you, and see, ta-da.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So from where you stand now, having gone through this, how would you advise an artist, let's even say a Pittsburgh artist, that is just mired down in that self-doubt and perhaps depression?
I would advise to not listen to all the naysayers. And again, in my play, there's a part where a sorority sister tears up words that I've written. And she says, do not ever let anyone tell you what you can't do, because that's their opinion, not a fact. And I think that it is so important to not have self-doubt clutter and negative words clutter your mind. If you think you are a good writer, continue to write. It's a lot of work. You know, my advice would be, it is work. If you want something to look great, you have to do it with a lot of work. I can sit in an audience and tell if someone has not worked on what they're doing. Mm-hmm. I know they know if I haven't worked on what I'm doing. I deliberately go to bad plays so that I know, don't do that.
You are a better person than
I
am.
Sit through the whole play. Some people say, why do you do that? Just get up, act like you're going to the bathroom and never come back. No, I want to sit through it because as a director, I'm thinking, why didn't that work? So when I'm telling someone that I'm coaching or that I'm directing, don't do that. Why? Because I've seen this play, the guy did it, and it messed up.
Now, see, I'm glad to hear you say this because, you know, I have worked as an actor, a playwright, a director, mm-hmm. and a producer. It's hard for me to go and enjoy theater.
You'll leave?
No. Oh. No, you know, I was exaggerating a little bit when I said that, but... It feels like a little bit of work for me because I can never relax and just enjoy it because I'm always thinking, what would I have done if I was directing this? How would I have, you know, lit Definitely. This or done this? I can't relax. I almost feel like it's like being in the office on the weekend.
Yeah.
I mean, so when you see a play that's not yours, that you have no affiliation with other than having bought a ticket and come in to observe it, you know, what is going through your mind as an actress, a director, and a playwright?
When it's a good play, I'm thinking, oh, I want to steal that idea. Oh, they spun around and their costumes didn't fall off. And so it's amazing. And I will see that play over again. I may see it one time as an audience, and then the second time I see it as the director or the actor is what I would do. But if I see a bad play, I only see it one time, but I don't leave. And I want to know, why did the director let them do that? Or especially, my biggest pet peeve is a back to the audience the whole time.
Mm.
Why is your back to the audience? Why
now that's,
is your back to the audience? So I'm thinking, did the director tell them to do that, or do they know the audience paid to see their face? And so, and at the end, and I really do go to, not the director, but to the actor, and I'll say, did you know your back was to the audience the whole time? And he'll say, oh, no, for real? I'm thinking, yeah, for real. So now if they say, oh, no, for real, I'm thinking, why didn't your director tell you? But I actually want to know why that was done the way that it was.
It would mystify me, too, at that level.
Yeah, and so if there is something really not gelling on that stage, it's a learning experience for me so that I don't have to learn the hard way. It's like someone tells you, don't put your hand in the fire, it'll burn. But if I just sat there, put my hand in the fire, and I said, see? Then that's a whole different story right there, you know? So I don't want to put my hand in the fire in my creative sense.
Now, I, you know, sitting chatting with you, having, you know, read about you, listened to interviews that you've done, you strike me, in my mind, what I would define as a true Pittsburgh artist.
Okay.
You're from here, mm-hmm. born in Pittsburgh, you have stayed here, mm-hmm. you work here. Has this city at all shaped you as an artist?
You know, I will say it has. I have received so many opportunities here. Mark Southers from the Pittsburgh Playwrights Theater here, he was the first one to give me a directing opportunity, and I've directed several plays here. He's also was the first person here to believe in my work, to produce my work here. And so I will say that the Pittsburgh Playwrights Theater and Country Repertory Theater, New Horizon Theater, years back were the only theaters that I circulated with. But from my work there, now I've gone into mainstream, as I've said. I haven't done city theater or playhouse or things like that yet. But Bricolage and No Name Theater, and I've been a mainstay in some of theirs. You know, I've done The Swan, supporting women artists now.
Mm-hmm.
I've done Bus with Bricolage. And I've gained a respect because I think I have this bicultural type of thing. I can go into the hood and say, yo, yo, what's up? How you doing? What's up? But I can also go into off-the-wall theater and speak as if I have some type of relaxed knowledge of my craft. And I like that. I like that I'm getting this respect. I like the fact that people are not just respecting me as Kim, but my work, you know? Because I would hate for someone to say, oh, well, she's an African-American. We need someone that's African-American to be in our clique or to be in our circle or to be there because we want to maintain this sense of equal opportunity. My work gets done because my work is decent, that people like my work. And I try not to put anything out, whether it's on stage with my acting or with my writing or with my directing, that is not up to par. And I want someone to tell me that was BS. Don't ever do that again. Because I will high-five them and say, thank you.
Yes.
Because I don't want to be out there talking, people talking like I'm talking about the bad theater.
Right.
No.
Excellent. Excellent. Now
don't ever do that, Brian. Pull me aside and say, Kim, your stuff was a mess.
As you did, actually, before we started rolling, mm-hmm. Corrected me on a common misconception that your name is pronounced Kim L. It is Kim Eel.
Mm-hmm.
And you also said to me that you are always very polite and usually do not correct anybody. So we wanted to, you know, state publicly here on Bergvon, maybe even for the first time.
Yeah, because this will be history. They'll say, I thought it was L, because it looks like L, but it's actually pronounced ill. And some people do pronounce it L. I mean, you have Randall L, and my sister even sometimes says her name is Cheryl L. And I guess it's because of the politeness, but it's ill, like electric buzz.
Yes, and you've heard it here, ladies and gentlemen. Introducing Kim Eel.
Yay!
Now, you mentioned Pittsburgh Playwrights Theater, and of course, that's where we are hosting, who is hosting us for the interview here today.
This is like my second home.
Yeah, and you've had some great experiences here, performed in one of August Wilson's plays. And I did hear you say previously that was one of your
favorites.
Yes. What was that experience like?
I played Black Mary in August Wilson's Gem of the Ocean. And quite honestly, I thought I was too old to play Black Mary. And Mark believed in me to play that, and it was just so awesome because I did research for her, and I didn't know who she was, and she was a female from 1904 in the Hill District. And because I was born and raised in the Hill District, it was a challenge to play her, but I could feel her on the stage. And the audience loved it. Actually, I had seen someone, and they were telling me on the street, I seen August Wilson's Jim of the Ocean, and they didn't know I was Black Mary, and I loved it. That's the biggest compliment. And I said, yes, I loved it. And I said,
when they know you in Target and don't know you on the street.
Yes, they know me. Well, you know, I don't think a lot of people, because I was in character with Black Mary.
So that is a compliment,
yeah,
then.
Yeah, it is, because in Straightening Combs, I was me. But in Black Mary, I was Black Mary, and it's 1904, and I had on layers of clothes, and I was dressed as someone from 1904 Pittsburgh Hill District. And so that was just an awesome, and I will forever be beholden and thanking Mark for allowing me to have that. Because in this theater community, some plays that are done, like August Wilson play, is to be able to do one is a great thing. I've done two. I played Fira in Seven Guitars, and I played Black Mary. August Wilson's plays don't have too many women in them. Mm-hmm. Usually one or two women. Jim of the Ocean has about three women. And so to get an August Wilson female part is like a cat fight here. So it's like, wow! Yeah,
but came out on top that
Yay!
Time.
Yeah, so if I never ever do another play, I mean, I would like to direct some more, because now most of the women are younger in the plays. So I would like to direct an August Wilson play. And I would also like to just be an advisory in the August Wilson, because I had the opportunity to meet him several times.
And how was that? What was he like?
It was great. I always tell this story. When I first met him, I was a student at Duquesne University, and I met him. He was at the Crawford Grill on the Hill, some function. And I said, I was with my mom, and I said, Mom, that's August Wilson.
Did he have
that's
the hat?
August Wilson. He didn't have the hat on. Not that day. But he had the cigar. He had his cigar that he always, his famous cigar. And I said, Mr. Wilson. And I'm talking real fast. I'm a student. I'm a journalism student at Duquesne University. Can you give me some advice as a young writer? And he took the cigar out of his mouth and he said, write. And he walked away. And I said to my mother, oh, I wasn't saying anything. You know, I wanted him to give me some profound, long conversations. First you need to do this, and then you get your life together, and then you do that, blah, 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 blah. But as I got older, I understood what that meant. If you want to be a writer, write. If you want to be an artist, draw. If you want to be a basketball player, continue to play basketball and do it to your best. And it took years later to understand that what he said was very profound. If you want to be a writer, and that's the advice I would give any playwright, write. Mm-hmm. Whether you like it or no one else likes it, just write, and then you come back and revisit it and rewrite. And that's what I'd taken from that. And so when I think about it, I was at the time kind of pissed off. But right now, I'm happy that I had this opportunity. Who'd have thought he was going to be August Wilson? You know, I just thought he was like a playwright from Pittsburgh.
But there was great wisdom in that one word.
In that word, write, and he's one of my most favorite writers.
It's wonderful that you did get to meet him.
Yay, yes. And took a picture with him, yeah.
So, yeah, and you do strike me as somebody who does not wait around for opportunity. You make opportunity.
I try.
And I think that is a great philosophy to live by, you know, as an artist. So what is the next big thing for Kim Eel?
Next big thing besides my Straightening Comb performance in October is to finish my poetry books. I have short stories. I have a lot of unfinished books in my laptop. And I think, I know that the more I do Straightening Combs, the more I know that and that's what the play is about, straightening out the kinks in your life. So I'm straightening out the kinks. People think the play is about hair, and it's not really about hair. It's about going forward and straightening things that have been dents and kinks and curves in your life. And so I want to straighten out myself. And in doing so, I want to revisit things that I've half finished. I have half books, I have half plays, I have a lot of things that I would like to finish, and the next thing would be my poetry books.
You need like a working vacation.
I do. Let's say that again, so it'll be in the atmosphere. Working vacation. Jamaica sounds good.
I was going to ask you, where would you go to relax? Where would you go to unwind?
My girlfriend asked me, she said, you know what, my birthday's in November, both of our birthdays, and she said, you know where you should go? You know where there's a lot of nice looking men? Jamaica. I said, hey, Jamaica sounds like a winner.
So are you a single lady?
I am single by choice.
Okay, so we won't advertise that then.
Yeah, I tell people I'm single by choice because I've learned that, unfortunately, in relationships that I've been in, I get distracted. I start putting more of myself into the relationship and the male part and not into me. And since I've been single, I've received awards. I recently received the New Pittsburgh Courier's 50 Women of Excellence. And when they sent that to me in the email, and they said, you've been chosen as one of the 50 Women of Excellence for Arts and Entertainment. And so you were supposed to send a response back, and I didn't. And they sent me an email and said, don't you want it? But I really thought, because I sometimes do doubt myself, I was like, are they serious? But I when your peers do that, it gives you some type of understanding that there's something going on with you that is purposeful. Yeah, and that's where I'm at right now.
Well, that's very wise of you to see that.
Yeah.
Now, did you eventually accept the award?
I did accept the award. Hey.
Very well deserved.
And I thank you, New Pittsburgh Courier, for giving me that acknowledgement, because it also helped to layer me now in a different respect for myself.
So if you can't get too far away, what are some of your places to go, favorite places to go in Pittsburgh? What do you like to do here?
I love, believe it or not, my favorite Pittsburgh place is Mount Washington. I feel close to angels there. I go to Mount Washington, my highest point is Mount Washington. Two favorite points of lower geographical area is the point to sit near the water. Both places have this view of the rivers, the three rivers, how they connect, and I love that. That's probably why I'm still here. My friends say, you should have been in California, you should go here, you should go to Chicago, you should go to Atlanta, and you would be famous by now, but I have this local fame that I love, and another favorite spot is Highland Parks. There's that little pond in Highland Park where the ducks swim around. I can write there, and I write on the train. Amtrak, I jump on the train, and that's my best mode of transportation. I wrote Straightening Combs on a train. I write most of my poetry on a train, because you can get up and walk to the dining area and write up. I will probably write a play about the train trip, but I love to see the countryside on a train. I think it's the most peaceful and therapeutic thing that has ever happened to me. And yes, so Mount Washington, Point Park, and Highland Park's little pond pool area near the swimming pool.
We do live in a great and wonderful city, geographically, culturally.
And the people here are really nice.
Oh, yeah.
Really, they really are. Some of them. Most of them, I guess. Yeah. And when people say, oh, I don't believe you like Pittsburgh, I said, you don't know the right people. You have to know the right people.
Good. Stand up for Pittsburgh like that.
And I think that even if I ever lived somewhere else, I would always come back to Pittsburgh.
They need to hang out with us, I think.
They should. You like Pittsburgh?
I love it.
And what's your favorite spot, since you've asked me?
I do love Point State Park.
Yes.
Whenever I go there, I make a point to stand at the point, because it's kind of like a little nexus of the universe.
Oh, really?
Where the rivers either come together, split apart, however you want to look at it. And it just geographically, it's so interesting, because behind you is the bustling city, business, skyscrapers. Then you have Mount Washington to your left, which kind of closes you in a little bit. Everything is open to the north side. And then you've got a submarine across from you, this wonderful pinnacle of learning and knowledge, which is Carnegie Science Center. I like to stand there and, in the center of the universe that is Pittsburgh, right there, I feel at peace.
Oh, yes. I mean, I used to come to the point to practice my poetry, and one of my mentors, K.L. Brewer, used to make me say these poems out very loud, like, say it again. He would turn his back to me and just say the poem, and you could see the water and feel the wind blowing, but it was something in the energy at the point that's a creative force that I love. Same thing at the top of Mount Washington. Mm-hmm. I would say poetry at the top of Mount Washington and give it back to Pittsburgh. Say poetry into the water and give it back to Pittsburgh. And again, so if I ever leave for like to live somewhere else, I will always come back here.
And you do give a lot to this city, and in my mind, I think that's what makes you a true Pittsburgh star.
Thank you.
Kim Eel, thank you so much for chatting with me and having drinks with me tonight. It was a pleasure talking to you. Cheers, my dear.
Cheers.
In closing, we would like to once again thank our spectacular sponsors and strategic partners, Off the Wall Theater, Cefalo's Banquet and Events Center, Carnegie, Pennsylvania, Arcade Comedy Theater, Downtown, and Bergvivant is a proud supporter of Firefly Arts, creating opportunities and support for families living with autism through innovative arts programming. Find out more and show your support at fireflyarts.org. And be sure to follow Pittsburgh's Cultural Talk magazine online. You can find Bergvivant, the It in Pittsburgh, on Facebook, Twitter, or subscribe for free at www.bergvivant.com. This is Brian Edwards saying cheers and good night.